Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. Several years ago, cardiologist Bob Carey, MD, decided he wanted his grandchildren to understand how much he had learned over his 56-year career, not from his colleagues or from medical school, but from his patients and their caregivers. Quote, I wanted to share their kindness and courage, he explains. I wanted to write stories about my patients so my 12 grandchildren could learn from them as I had. His daughter shared what he had written to an author who encouraged Bob to realize a book. This past year, Dr. Carey's dream finally came true within the pages of Patients Teach a Doctor About Life and Death, Tales from 56 Years of Practicing. Dr. Carey, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Hello.
Hello. Dr. Carey, in your wonderful book, you know, you begin with your early years at Boston University's Medical School's main teaching hospital, which is now called Boston Medical Center. And that was in the early 1950s. And you tell the story of treating your very first patient, Gladys. Can you tell us about Gladys and also about your first weeks there?
Sure. This was my first chance to actually be with a patient, and I was thrilled. And it was a lovely woman who looked very ill, and she was with the oncologist. So she had a cancer. And they were very worried, and I saw her first, and they set her up for some tests, and they biopsied a gland in her neck, and it showed Hopkins disease.
Oh.
So it was a fatal disease in those days, and I was shocked to hear it. And they began radiation, and each time I would be with her when they did these procedures and when they did the radiation. And she talked to me a little bit, and I got to see her daughter. Two daughters came in with her, one or the other, and one of them was carrying a little baby. So I got to talk more to the daughters, really, than to the patient. While she was getting the treatments. But after the third radiation treatment, she said, I don't want any more. I don't feel well with it. I'm not afraid to die. And I have a wonderful husband and children. And I want to go home and be with my husband. And those were the days when most women stayed home, unlike today. So she... when she said this, I was all upset, and her daughter was crying when she said it. So it was a very emotional time, and I watched her walking out, and she leaned, one of the daughters, the one with the baby, turned around to me and just said, like a wave goodbye with tears flowing down her face. And I never saw her again. And maybe 10 years later, when I had finished medical school and residency and had started to practice and was trying to get patients, and there was a lovely new woman working in the laboratory. And we started chatting, and she asked if I would see her mother to take care of her. So I was thrilled because I was just starting, and when the laboratory comes and wants to you, I felt pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So in comes the lady, a very obese woman. By the way, the patient I had was very slim, as you can imagine, with the cancer.
Okay.
So we talked for a minute, and all of a sudden she started to cry and said, oh, you're my medical student, and started crying and running over hugging me. It was the same lady.
Oh, it's incredible.
And I just couldn't believe it. I never knew whether her daughter knew it was me, the same guy, or not. I never found out. I never had the courage to ask her. But she came in, started crying too, and... Anyhow, She stayed my patient for about 20 years and died of other things.
Oh, that's so wonderful that she got better, though, at that time and was able to, you know, she remembered you, and that's just fabulous. Now, in part one in your book, you share about that your sister died, and first off, I'm so sorry, and how did that experience, or did that experience influence you to go into medicine?
Oh, yes. Two things made me go into medicine. First of all, my father always said he'd like me to be a doctor, and he wasn't a doctor. And I always said that that's the last thing I want to do. I don't want to do it. And I became very sick with an appendix. And at the height of depression, it was very hard to get physicians. Anyhow, I was very sick and had terrible pain. And finally, we got a doctor to see me, and I had appendicitis, but I had ruptured my appendix, and it was before we had any treatment. So we had no antibiotics, and somehow I survived, and I was loved the nurses who took care of me. I loved the doctor who operated on me, and he operated on me immediately when he saw me. And so that made me kind of want to do it. And then my sister got cancer at about age 19, and I was about 16, and I watched her die.
Oh my God.
And that was a terrible loss. We were really very close. I can never remember having a fight with my sister.
So
she was very nice to her kid brother.
I was going to say, that's rare. No fighting.
Yeah. Oh, she was a wonderful, wonderful girl. Very talented musician and very bright and everything. And when she died, I wanted to be a physician, definitely.
Wow. You know, speaking of wonderful girls, your last year of medical school in 1953 to 1954, you married your high school sweetheart, Mary. And I laughed out loud when I read that after going together for 10 years, Mary's mother's reaction to your getting married was, "So soon?"
That's the good old Irish.
Oh, that's so funny. Now, you know, at that time, you got married and you were doing your internship, and you share a very disturbing story about something that a patient said to you and he asked you for your home address. What did he say?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Very disturbing.
Very disturbing, yeah. Yeah, I was in my internship. And just learning to put intravenous things in people, IV. And so I had probably done about two or three. And there was a patient who belonged to a private care doctor. Excuse me, he was not one of the poor people, but one of the wealthy people. And he was an Arab, actually. And he had a Jewish doctor, which is unusual.
Mm.
And not unusual, actually, in Israel.
Maybe here for that time.
Great medicine. The Jews have been in all the hot years of medicine. So anyhow, where was I?
Oh, you were talking about what he said to you. So you.
Oh yeah, yes. Yeah. So I started to put in an intravenous for him. His doctor called me and asked me to put an intravenous in him. So I set it all up. It was different from the days they are now, and was quite a bit painful for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little difficulty getting into a vein. And he was silent. And I finally got into a vein and got things going. And he said, "Doctor, what's your address?" And I told him. And he said, "Do you have are you married?" I said, "Yes, and I have a little child coming along." And he said, "Well, yes. You know, you hurt me a lot, and I'm going to blow up your house with you and your wife in it." And he turned over and faced the wall.
What did you do?
I was scared stiff.
Oh, my God. How old were you at this time? I mean, not that it would matter whatever age you would be,
how
terrified.
I was about, 35, maybe.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, about 35. So, anyhow, yeah, then I called the doctor. He's doctor, and told him what he had said. And I said, I want to call the police. And he said, oh, no. He's not that bad a man. He's not a bad man at all.
Yeah.
I'll take care of him. And I said, no. He's going to kill me and my daughter, my wife, my baby that's coming. And he said, no, and we will not have any of the other doctors see him but me. And I'll take care of him, and don't you worry. And I worried. But you see, I'm still here, so I guess he didn't do it.
Oh, that is so crazy. You know, and then in 1955, you were sent to Okinawa, and this was shortly after the birth of your first son, Bobby. How did you and Mary feel about this?
Well,
kind of
not
big
too
thing.
Happy. We weren't
yeah.
too happy.
Oh,
and I was supposed to go to the National Institute of Health, actually. I was then the doctor who got me to the that point to be in my service became the highest general physician he ever was in the government.
Oh.
And so he said it would be unselfish. I know it said it would be, bad if he sent anyone to the NIH. I never knew why that was true. And then I wound up in Okinawa, and I loved it.
Yeah, you know, you write, quote, this experience would change our whole lives.
It certainly did.
Yeah. Did it.
Patients were so poor. There was no sanitation at all. They had all kinds of parasites and were terribly sickly people. And, they were sort of the way we treated black people in Japan, Okinawa. Well, Okinawa was often by part of China, and then would be part of Japan, and was everybody, they were claiming it. And, so
oh, Bob,
was terrible.
You were going in and out for a minute. Okay, go on.
Yeah. So anyhow, it was great taking care of those patients, and I loved it. And,
when you returned from Okinawa in 1957, you write about doing your medical residency at the ER in Boston City Hospital, and there you saw drunk people and people with STDs, and you heard some horrendous stories, from women. And the most horrendous story, and I still can't get over this, was a 14-year-old girl with a hanger inside her, and she and her family were completely nonchalant, like it was no big. They're like, "Oh, okay." Just the fact that it was there, but then the reaction to it, I just, if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Okay.
And how you felt.
Yeah. Well, this was a very family-looking family. Their clothes would probably be 10 years of mine on very wealthy people.
Mm.
And they had a patient. This daughter, like I said, has been feeling ill. And would I see her? And would she be seen? And the family doctor was not there, so I had to see her. And I examined her, and she said she had a little trouble passing her urine, and she was having fever, and she didn't feel well. This is what she was saying, now the little girl, when I asked her. So I had a nurse with me, and she was about 14, and her body was about 18, and a beautiful girl. And so I asked her if it would be all right if I did a look at her vagina, and she said yes. And so I got the nurse, right with her very carefully and very gently, and there was a coat hanger coming out of her urine at her urethra and into her on the other end into her vagina.
Ugh.
And it was just horrible. Oh my God. And the nurse ran out and was vomiting.
Yeah, I mean
it was just unbelievable. So I went back to the family and told them, and they just looked like, oh really? And they didn't say anything. And they called the gynecologist, and he came right down. And I came up to him. He was not the reason I was seeing her, he was not at the hospital, but he came right over. And they took care of her, and I asked how things came out, and they said they thought she would be okay for, to have a pregnancy.
Well, I'm obviously she must have been trying to abort a baby. I mean,
exactly.
It's not, unfortunately, what a lot of women, I mean, you have happy stories and sad stories, and we only have like a couple minutes left, but if you can share, after that story, maybe one of your happiest stories with
happy
us.
Happy story? Happy story. Well, okay. I was in the emergency room at the hospital. I guess you like the hospital. So I was in the emergency room at the Boston City Hospital as a resident and seeing patients, and it was mobbed, and there were people in gynies in the corridor. So there was a little African-American girl about 18 years old who was, they told me, was a drunk. I just, you know, that's what the nurses said. She's a drunk. So I went over and looked at her, and I sniffed. And when people told me they were drunk, I would always sniff them because sometimes they were drunk. Well, she wasn't. She didn't have no odor of alcohol.
Oh.
And she was barely sponsoring back when I would ask her something. And finally, I started examining her, and I got a nurse with me, and she said, "Oh my God, it's not alcohol. Oh, doctor, what are we going to do?" And so we started examining her. I examined her abdomen, and she seemed to be a little sore when I did that, but she barely, she would go, "Oh," you know. And then I got a little farther along, and I saw a hole in her. She had dungarees on, and it was in her right hip. And then I looked at the left hip, and it would come out the other side. It was right through her pelvis, really. And obviously, it was a bullet. So that changed everything. We got the doctor, the surgeons down, and they just rushed to surgery. And she had successful surgery, thank God. And they said she, too, I asked if they thought she could have a child, and they said yes. And we later found that she was was stealing hubcaps because the poor Africans often did that in the heart of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And at that day, hubcaps would fall off your car and you'd have to get new ones.
Oh,
and so
I see.
Taking them off was a way to get a dinner. And that's what she was doing with her boyfriend that day when she was shot. And they saw someone saw her and who he saw her taking it off his hubcap, and he shot her.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow, you have seen, you know, we could talk all day. I wish we had time, but I just want to say to people, you know, Dr. Carey, your book, Patients Teach a Doctor About Life and Death, has so many amazing stories, tales from 56 years of practicing. Now, Dr. Carey, do you have a website or a way people can learn more about
you?
Sure.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, if they get on Google, just put Bob Carey, M.D.
Okay.
And if they know the title of the book, it's even better. But if you Bob Carey, M.D., you can get right to the right to it. Yep.
Oh, well, terrific. Well, I want to thank you so much. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. I hope everyone has a great day. Take care.